Well, the Lansing State Journal's Eric Lacey visited Current State last week to help us understand some of the nuances stemming from this separation agreement involving former city attorney Janine McIntyre from the city of Lansing, and the discussion that has ensued about that on the Lansing City Council. Now, regarding yesterday's city council meeting, Eric writes today that several city council members, quote, want to do what they can under the city charter to prevent more payouts, unquote, from happening. That payout apparently amounted to $160,000 and possibly more, according to some council members. Now, yesterday on this program, council member Kathy Dunbar said the city charter clearly gives the mayor the authority to negotiate these settlements and that confidentiality is the norm in most negotiations, suggesting, I think, that this whole situation is not going to change unless the charter changes. Lacey's story says the council ended up not voting on whether to hire outside legal counsel in order to learn more about the McIntyre separation agreement. This is Current State on WKAR. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Mark Bayshore. Criminal justice reform has been a hot topic in Michigan recently. Prison sentences in this state are among the longest in the country, and the state spends a large amount on its general fund budget, about 20%, on corrections programs. Now, some of these issues are moving in the Michigan legislature. The House recently approved a nearly 20-bill package that addresses juvenile sentencing and medical parole guidelines. A similarly sized package of bills has just been introduced in the Michigan Senate, many of which pertain to parole rules. Joining me now to help us understand these developments is Barbara Levine, Associate Director of Research and Policy for CAPS, the Citizens Alliance on Prisons and Public Spending. Barb, nice to have you back on Current State.
Nice to be back. Thank you, Mark.
For starters, do we know how many inmates are in Michigan prisons today?
A little under 43,000. The number has been declining on the men's side. It's going up still a little on the women's side.
Okay. Your organization made a series of recommendations not quite a year ago. You visited this program to discuss them. CAP suggested that Michigan could significantly reduce its prison population by about 10,000 inmates. With those recommendations, you maintain that Michigan routinely keeps inmates in prison past their minimum sentencing. Why are inmates kept incarcerated so long in this state?
Well, there's a variety of reasons why Michigan's length of stay is longer than other states, but one of the issues is how parole guidelines are used. And there's a bill that's passed the House now called presumptive parole or evidence-based parole that would tackle that problem. Michigan has parole guidelines that say when someone is assessed as being at a low risk for reoffending, they're supposed to be paroled when they've served their minimum sentence, unless there are substantial and compelling reasons not to release them. Unfortunately, the statute, which has been on the books since 92, doesn't define substantial and compelling reasons, and that phrase has been interpreted quite differently by various board members. So there's a lack of consistency in whether people who have served their minimum and are low risk actually get released at their first eligibility date. And the presumptive parole bill that has passed the House would contain some definitions, some clear, narrow definitions of what substantial and compelling reasons would be, and the Michigan Department of Corrections anticipates as a result that alone would save about 3,200 beds in 5 years. So consistent application of parole standards would go a long way to helping to reduce our length of stay.
Well, the House passed the presumptive parole measure last October. It's been in the Senate ever since. What is the Senate grappling with in that measure exactly?
Well, there's been some opposition to the bill that, frankly, is based on a lot of misinformation. There have been some, you know, stories circulating about parolees who've committed very serious offenses, but hardly any of them were low risk when they were released, so they're not from the population that would even be affected by presumptive parole. And of course, they're a very small percentage of all the parolees that are released. There's been concern about what the impact on county costs would be of releasing more parolees, but the fact is we release 10,000 parolees a year. We're talking about releasing, you know, another 1,000 or so a year.
That's all that measure would do? It'd bump it up by 1,000?
Well, in order to get to 3,200 beds saved in 5 years, yeah, it's a small additional percentage, but it has a cumulative effect because those people get denied for a year at a time or 18 months at a time, and so it's cumulative. But, yeah, and again, because these are the lowest risk folks, they're unlikely to reoffend, and they're certainly unlikely to reoffend in very serious ways, and so the impact on, you know, county jails of people committing new offenses would be very small. So there's this sort of rhetoric out there that's concerning legislators, but the fact is there are it's a lot of misinformation, and the answers to all of it is quite simple. And the bottom line is it is really a way of simply enforcing a statute that's been on the books for years and making the administrative decision-making in parole more consistent.
We're talking about a series of criminal justice reforms that are moving through the Michigan House and Senate. Our guest is Barb Levine, Associate Director for Policy and Research for CAPS, the Citizens Alliance on Prisons and Public Spending. Let's talk about the package that just passed out of the Michigan House. There's a number of new reforms that now go to the Senate. One of them takes 17-year-olds who commit crimes out of the hands of adult criminal courts and gives jurisdiction to family courts. Would giving family courts a bigger role be a good thing?
It's certainly something. Raising the age of criminal responsibility from 17 to 18 is certainly something we've advocated. We didn't take the lead on these bills, but it's the whole package is certainly something that we support. Right now, 17-year-olds are considered adults in Michigan, and it's one of only 9 states in the country that does that. The norm nationally is certainly 18. And the more there has been scientific research into brain development, the more raising the age becomes the importance of that becomes clear. 17-year-olds, as any parent knows, are kids. They're impulsive. They don't think long-term, and they should be treated like kids. That said, this bill would not change the fact that those kids who commit the most serious offenses, whether they're 17 or younger, could still be waived into adult court and treated as adults. So it's not that no kids would end up in prison, but 17-year-olds who are now treated as adults, no matter what the seriousness of their crimes are, and hundreds end up in prison every year for things like B&E or, you know, drugs or things that short of murder and robbery, those kids would be treated in the first instance as juveniles.
The House also passed a medical parole measure. This affects a small number of prisoners, but I imagine this comes out of a substantial cost savings for the state. Can you explain what the medical parole reform would do?
It would allow medically frail prisoners, whether it's a mental illness like dementia, whether it's a serious illness that may not even be age-related like, you know, cancer, or whether it's disabilities due to age that make people absolutely very low risk, virtually no risk, it would allow them to go be paroled, even though they would not otherwise be eligible for parole yet, and go to nursing homes on the outside. Yes, the hope in part is that this is in large part, it's a cost savings, and that Medicaid would ultimately pick up these costs. That's still in negotiation. There are other states who have similar proposals going, and they're negotiating with the feds about the cost pickup. But it's also a question of humanity and of prison management. I mean, our prisons are not designed to be nursing homes, but we have, you know, geriatric units at a couple of prisons now, and you've got people who are housed both at great expense and you know, under difficult conditions, you know, who are very, very frail. Mm. So they simply They're no risk to the public. There's no logic to having them in prison, and they could get suitable care outside.
Another bill that's still pending in the House, in a House committee, pertains to the concept of judicial veto, and this affects people serving life sentences who are up for parole. What's the issue there?
Actually, that's out of committee. It's pending on the House floor, and we hope that it will get voted out next week.
Okay, noted.
That's people who are sentenced to parolable life, who become eligible for release if they were committed their offense before 92, became eligible after serving 10 years. Now parolable lifers have to serve 15 years. But our law allows, and it's quite unique, allows either the sentencing judge who actually imposed the sentence or that judge's successor to file an objection to the release of that prisoner. And even though the board has vetted the person and considered their history thoroughly and determined that they may well be good candidates for release, the process can be stopped cold by the objection of a successor judge who had nothing to do with the original sentence, has no firsthand knowledge of the prisoner or the case. Most judges don't exercise that authority. They'd rather defer to the board because they recognize that they don't have the real information to make a good decision. But there are some judges who choose to exercise this, and about 25% of the parolable lifers on whom the board wants to proceed end up being vetoed. And so they sit there, waiting another 5 years for another review, hoping that a different successor judge somewhere down the road won't object. So what this bill would do is say that successor judges can get notice of the parole board's intentions to proceed and offer comment, but unlike the original sentencing judge, they would not, their objections would not be binding on the board.
Barbara Levine is our guest. Barbara's Associate Director for Policy and Research for CAPS, the Citizens Alliance on Prisons and Public Spending. We're talking about a series of criminal justice reforms that are moving through the Michigan House and Senate. There's always some degree of pushback with legislation that reduces prison terms and eases parole restrictions. We'll hear expressions of caution or outright concern from prosecuting attorneys, county sheriffs, and others in law enforcement that this is leniency that endangers public safety. To what extent are those concerns justified?
All of the bills that we've just discussed, the juvie bills are a different concept, but the presumptive parole, the medical paroles, and the judicial veto all have to do with releasing low-risk offenders. In the case of the medical paroles, you're talking about people who wouldn't even have the capacity to harm anyone if they wanted to. The judicial veto involves people who the parole board have served, in most cases, 25, 30, 35 years. These are also older prisoners who the board has very carefully vets and doesn't decide on until after a public hearing at which anyone can testify. And, of course, presumptive parole, the single biggest piece of all this, applies only by definition to people who score low risk on the department's risk assessment instrument. So
okay.
Public safety is at the core of all of these. They all go to the notion that we should not be incarcerating people who aren't a threat to the public longer than necessary, either for their own sake or for the taxpayers' sake.
We spent not as much time on the Michigan Senate bills as I would have liked, but we have to leave it there. We want to thank our guest, Barb Levine, Associate Director for Policy and Research for CAPS, the Citizens Alliance on Prisons and Public Spending. We've been talking about criminal justice reforms moving through the Michigan House and the Michigan Senate. Barbara Levine, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
And coming up on Current State, an Ann Arbor-based organization has been planting trees all over Michigan since 1988. ReLeaf Michigan helps property owners learn about trees and how to plant them, citing their numerous benefits. We'll hear the group's story from Executive Director Melinda Jones coming up. The The year is 1976. Gerald Ford is president. Our nation comes together for a big bicentennial party. A little film called Rocky tops the movie box office. And the Detroit Tigers are headed for a fifth-place finish in the American League Eastern Division. They also have baseball's biggest star. Pitcher Mark Fidrich took baseball and the sports world by storm in 1976. His 19 wins brought him Rookie of the Year honors and an All-Star Game appearance. Mark's hyperactive pitching antics captured the imagination of fans across the country. His gangly strut around the infield earned him the nickname The Bird. By midseason, a Fidrich start on the mound guaranteed a packed stadium anywhere in the league. A 2013 book by lifelong Tiger fan Doug Wilson remembers Fidrich, who died in 2009. WKAR's Al Martin spoke with Wilson about his bio, The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fidrich. The conversation started with Wilson remembering Fidrich's early appearances.
Well, he came up, he was kind of an unknown to most media and fans. You could do that back in those days. They didn't have all the internet and things to track people. But he had had a very good year in the minors the year before, but he was a non-roster pitcher in spring training in 76. He made the team. Hawk pitched him in relief a couple times to let him get his feet wet, and he didn't make his first start till about the middle of May. Mm-hmm. But when he took the mound against the Indians in Detroit, he threw a two-hitter, won the game 2-1, and the guys in the other dugouts, the guys in the press box started noticing that not only was he winning games, he was doing some pretty strange things out on the field.
We watch you tonight, patting the mound, talking to the ball, it looks like, or talking about location. Is that what you're doing out there?
Well, when I pat the mound, I'm just keeping it so I don't, you know, get in that guy's road. I want to dig my own hole and my own landing point and all that, because I have my own thing. And then I'm just getting myself psyched, telling it, don't let up now. Just go as high as you can, as high as you can. And if they burn you, they burn you. That's, you know, life. But I got lucked out tonight, and I had the great D behind me in the run, too.
I tell you, you didn't
and over the next month, it just gradually built up. More people were coming out.
Now, Doug, I read that Mark was just such a popular player that opposing teams would sometimes even ask the Tigers if he would pitch on a certain day while on the road, just to attract people. I mean, certainly a cultural figure. I mean, even the first athlete to grace the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. I mean, talk about his impact culturally.
Well, like you said, after halfway through the season, almost every game he pitched, there were 40,000 to 50,000 fans, home and on the road. He single-handedly outdrew four other teams for the season just in his 29 starts. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the general managers knew if the Bird made an appearance in their park, that was a sellout that night. And so they wanted them to juggle the lineup. But, you know, everywhere he went, the fans were there. People were in the airport, grocery stores, hanging around his apartment. But he really loved it. He was just a guy who enjoyed connecting with people. And the fans could see that. And that's what kept making them come back.
Right, definitely. Now, Doug, what was Mark's lifestyle like away from baseball?
Well, he was pretty famously casual. He was from a real small town in Massachusetts, and after his first big game, People magazine sent a reporter over to his apartment, and you know, they reported to the country he had sheets hanging on the windows instead of curtains. He was sleeping on a mattress on the floor, didn't have a bed, didn't have a telephone, didn't have a TV. He told the reporter, he said, yeah, I'm usually clean, but every now and then I let my dishes stack up, but they don't get too high because I only have four. And so he was happy just living a simple lifestyle. And you know, he was making the major league minimum, $16,000 a year, which is pretty unbelievable nowadays looking at the salaries. But the reporters asked him, you know, you're drawing $500,000 every game. You should be getting more money. And he told him, what do I want more money for? 2 years ago, I was making $2 an hour at a gas station. This is more than I ever had.
Wow.
And, you know, he was happy with that. He didn't get an agent. He negotiated his contract by himself. And, you know, he was loyal to the Tigers. And, you know, fans ate that up. That was what they wanted to hear at the time.
We're talking with Doug Wilson. He has a new book highlighting Mark Fidrich's life. Fidrich was, of course, a Detroit Tigers pitching legend back in the day. They nicknamed him The Bird. Doug's book is called The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fitrich. So, Doug, now Mark was injured. He injured his knee in 1977, an injury that he worked through, but it was when he injured his rotator cuff that really hindered his career. When he got his shoulder repaired, did he ever talk about returning back to the game?
One of the frustrating things was when he hurt his arm, that was before the days of MRIs and things like that, so they didn't really know he had a torn rotator cuff, and so he tried for about 5 years to come back. You know, he tried everything, all kinds of hokey diets, medicine, hypnotism, but after he had finally retired, about 2 years later, he went down to Dr. James Andrews, and by then they could do arthroscopic surgery, and they found the rotator cuff and fixed it. But by then he had been out of baseball 3 years. He was 33, and his life had moved on, and so it was too late.
So what was life for him like after baseball?
I was actually pretty good. Again, when he was a young kid on top of the world, he had always told reporters he liked trucks, he liked fiddling with engines, and he wanted to be a farmer. Of course, they thought, you know, that's just more evidence of him being a nut. But when he got out, that's exactly what he did. He had saved some of his money. He bought some nice land in the small town that he lived in, raised pigs. He got a big dump truck, and he was basically a blue-collar worker. Get up at 5 in the morning, go haul asphalt and gravel all day, come home, work the pigs. And he was happy. Wow. He loved it. He married a girl from his high school, had a daughter, and he spent a lot of time doing charity work. He was always happy to put on his Tiger's hat, get out and meet people, and he never really expressed any bitterness for his injury or what happened.
Now, for you, Doug, when looking at Mark's life and putting together this book of yours, what do you think for you is the most fascinating part of his life when you were going through the process of putting this book together?
Well, again, that whole attitude of not being bitter. You know, if you look at it one way, he missed the free agent era, and by 2 years, he would have made millions. Mm-hmm. And, he missed the diagnosis and being able to fix his arm by 2 to 3 years. If they had fixed it, he could have had a 15, 20-year career. But, you know, he never looked back and felt bad about that. He always just told everybody he was happy for what he had and happy for what it got him. But, the other surprising thing is you talk to people now, it's hard to explain the phenomena of being in a ballpark when he was there because there's nothing to compare it to.
Right.
People talk about Lynn's sanity a few years ago, and I just say he made Lynn's sanity look like a church bingo party. I mean, you had 50,000 people just on their feet screaming nonstop the whole game.
I've seen a lot of ball games played, and I've caught a few. I don't think I've ever seen a pitcher this keyed up in the ninth inning of a ball game or all through the ball game. You'd think this guy'd be running out of gas by an hour, starting to get down a little bit. But he is just starting to heat it up.
What's getting me is he's giving me duck bumps, and I've watched over 8,000 ball games.
The fans are cheering, "Let's go, Mark." And now, the 3-2 to Hendricks. The fans ready to explode. Here's your pitch. Ground ball should be the ball game. It's over. And the Tigers act like Hendricks has just won the seventh game of the World Series.
He has. He's won 7 in a row. He is some kind of unbelievable young Mark Fitrich.
So Mark Fitrich thanking his teammates. Look at that. He's thanking his teammates.
Right. Every single game when he finished, they called him back out. You know, in a midseason game for a fifth-place team, they called him out for curtain calls every single game.
The fans are calling for him to come back. So Mark Fitrich, possibly the all-star pitcher with a record of 8-1, 8 complete games, stops the Yankees' winning streak at 5.
Wow.
And, there's nothing to compare it to because there hasn't been anything like that since.
Even Lynn, I remember when Lynn Sanity was taking off, man. I mean, everybody was talking about Jeremy Lin. You say that made a church bingo party is what you compared it to.
everybody say it was just a massive two-hour party every single time he took the mound.
21-year-old Mark Fitrich from Worcester, Mass. And here he comes! Here he comes! Oh, this is unbelievable. He loves him! Look at that! Shaking the policeman's hand!
This kid is terrific.
In my life, I've been in baseball 35 years. I have never in my life ever seen anything to equal this. The closest
he's
was when
crying.
Dale Long hit a home run. Why wouldn't he cry?
He's look so happy. He's look at this.
Wow. Like I said, I wish I had a time machine to go back. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Doug Wilson. He has a new book highlighting Mark Fittrich's life. Mark Fittrich's a legendary Tigers pitcher back in the late 70s. Doug has a new book out highlighting Mark's life entitled The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fittrich. So what do you think Mark's legacy is, Doug?
Again, a couple things. One is a guy who came along when baseball really needed it because the game was flagging. The game was dropping in popularity. He came along and made the game fun. He just enjoyed it. And then also a guy who gave back to his community, who was always willing to do charity, who always had a positive attitude after he got out of the game. And that's something that, a lot of modern players could look at that as a role of how to be remembered.
Doug Wilson, author of The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fittrich. Go pick it up. Doug, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, well, thanks for having me.
Coming up on Current State, next year marks the landmark 100th season of the Flint Symphony Orchestra's existence. We'll speak with Maestro Enrique Demec to learn a few of the highlights of the upcoming season as this great ensemble looks forward and looks back over the past century of music making. That and more coming up after the break on Current State. By the way, you can catch all of our Current State segments here. They call WKAR.org home, and you can listen to them anytime there. WKAR.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. A recent federal estimate puts the number of mature trees here in Michigan at about 107 million. About 29,000 of them are there because of the activities of ReLeaf Michigan, an Ann Arbor-based organization dedicated to planting trees and educating property owners about trees. The organization's motto is Healthy Trees, Healthy Communities. ReLeaf says its primary mission is educational. Yesterday, I spoke with Executive Director Melinda Jones.
We are trying to educate homeowners and children, students, people of all ages on the benefits of trees and the need to properly select, plant, and more importantly, maintain them. And we like to do this by providing opportunities for hands-on action with trees, such as with tree plantings and other tree-related projects.
Certainly, trees contribute a ton to the aesthetic appeal of the landscape, but what other ways do you consider them most valuable?
Trees are truly amazing, and in recent years, scientists have come up with all kinds of ways to quantify the benefits of trees. For example, trees decrease mental stress. Children who play in nature are more relaxed and attentive, which improves learning and performance. It decreases crime. It encourages walking. It can reduce stressful noises by up to 50%, like noises from the street. It gets people to slow down as they're driving through neighborhoods. It can increase your property value dramatically. It helps from an energy conservation perspective. If you plant trees, for example, going into the summer season here, if you plant trees on the west and northwest sides of a house, it will cut down dramatically on the heat that comes in. And, you know, if you plant over driveways, patios, that sort of thing.
What are some of the most common questions or maybe misunderstandings that property owners have about trees and planting trees?
I would have to say that people greatly underestimate how big a tree will grow. And as a result, they put it too close to their house or they put it in front of their you know, living room window, not knowing over the years how fast they grow and take up space. So it's definitely a right tree, right place situation. People unfortunately don't realize that even when planting trees around your own home, you should call Ms. Digg to make sure that there's nothing there that you're going to run into. And then also, they don't take into consideration the soil, what a tree likes. For example, what type of trees can handle moisture if you have a wet area in your backyard, sand, that sort of thing.
I know your organization is more involved, and I take it you advocate planting more mature trees as opposed to seedlings. Why is that?
Well, what we've found in the 28 years that we've been in existence is that normally only about 20% of seedlings planted survive. And seedlings do have a place. They're planted a lot throughout forests, that sort of thing. But we believe that trees which are of a larger size adapt more quickly, have a more immediate effect, and people like to see something bigger on their own property.
That must be more expensive, though, isn't it?
Larger trees do tend to be more expensive because obviously they've been in the ground in the nursery for a much longer period of time. However, they once planted, they have a more immediate effect. And a lot of people shy away from bare root trees. And actually, in the spring, bare root trees are less expensive, and they adapt actually quite quickly.
I'm talking with Melinda Jones, Executive Director of Releaf Michigan, which assists property owners with information about tree planting. You work with communities and execute what are called tree inventories. What value does a tree inventory have?
Tree inventories are the base of a community's tree plan. If you do not know what you have, then obviously you can't plan and you certainly can't budget. So what we do is work with smaller communities with volunteers to inventory their street trees to determine what type of trees they have, what type of condition they're in, where they're placed, where they could potentially use more trees, and then that information is turned into a database, which they can use to keep track of what they plant, what they remove, what they prune, and then ultimately what's planted.
I realize all environments might enjoy benefits from more trees. I mean, urban environment certainly, but even a rural or a suburban environment might benefit. But which setting in Michigan do you think could use them most? Rural, urban, suburban, which one?
Well, there's really, I would have to say, both urban and rural. And the reason being is that a lot of rural communities are older communities. And when they were planted with trees such as silver maples, which have now grown to the point where the limbs are breaking quite easily, and they've just outgrown the spot that they were put in. So they're having to be removed. So we do a lot of plantings throughout the state of Michigan with very small communities replacing their downtown trees. Second, of course, would be the more urban areas. As trees, as subdivisions go up and people move out, whatever, trees have a life expectancy. And once it's reached, they need to be replaced. And many times they aren't. As a matter of fact, when Releaf Michigan got started back in 1988, for every four trees being removed, only one was being replaced. And even today, that's still about the same ratio.
It seems as if environmentally it would be harder to grow a healthy tree in an urban environment. Is that true?
Yes, it is, because there's a lot more stress in an urban environment. You have a lot more pollution, and different trees react to pollution differently. You have salt. We have lots of snow, so they have to be able to tolerate salt. And also where you're going to plant them. A lot of times people want to plant them between the street and the sidewalk.
Yeah.
And what you plant needs to be determined by the size of that lawn width. Otherwise, again, the tree grows or outgrows it, and up comes the sidewalks, and they cause all kinds of problems.
These 29,000 trees that you say ReLEAF has planted here, is there a pattern to where they've been planted?
Yes, I would have to say so. ReLEAF Michigan, we definitely are a statewide community. We have planted trees from Copper Harbor down to Monroe. The majority of trees that we have planted have obviously been in southeast Michigan, mainly because that's where the majority of people live. And as homeowners learn about our organization, they give us a call, and that's how we plant. Our plantings are done only on public property, and they're done on a cost-sharing basis, 50-50. We feel very strongly that unless people have invested money into a planting, then there's no real reason for them to take care of it. And actually, it's a three-way cooperation, ourselves, the volunteers or the neighborhood that's interested, in the and then the community in which the trees are going to be planted. They help by providing the mulch, digging the holes, that sort of thing. So it's a three-way collaborative effort.
Again, I'm talking with Melinda Jones, Executive Director of ReLEAF Michigan. That's R-E-L-E-A-F Michigan, which assists property owners with information about tree planting. How big an issue are tree pests in our state?
That, unfortunately, has become quite an issue. It started a long time ago with the Dutch elm disease, so there are very few elm trees that grace our streets like they did originally. That's been followed with the emerald ash borer, which was extremely devastating. In the city of Ann Arbor alone, they lost over a million trees there. And now we're getting into the era of oak wilt. And while oak wilt itself has been around since in the 1980s, for some reason now it's picked up speed, and it's actually moved in up into northern and central Michigan, where the emerald ash borer, while it's all over the state, was predominantly down towards southeastern, southwestern Michigan, where more ash trees tended to be planted.
What do you consider the most interesting aspect of what your organization here does? What really gets your heart pumping about your work?
I just absolutely love to plant trees with people, not only myself, but everybody that works with us. Our organization is based highly on volunteers, and a lot of those volunteers are retired city foresters, nursery extension people, people who have worked in the green industry for a long time and for whatever reason just never tire of planting trees. And there's nothing more fulfilling for myself or for our volunteers than working with a group of homeowners and actually getting out there and getting dirty, learning the right way to plant trees, and then seeing what you've done. I mean, today people are inside so often, especially children, and they're tied into electronics. And they just get absolutely excited when they're outside and they see what they've planted. I mean, they even name the trees. It's really quite funny, but very fulfilling.
Melinda Jones is Executive Director of ReLEAF Michigan. That's R-E-L-E-A-F, Michigan.org. The organization assists property owners with information about tree planting. Melinda, thanks. Good luck.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
And this environmental segment of Current State is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news of the Great Lakes environment, you can check out greatlakesecho.org. This fall, the Flint Symphony Orchestra hits the century mark, and the 2016-17 season will be a celebration of those 100 years. Maestro Enrique Demek recently sat down with Current State's Jamie Paisley. Any anniversary surprises the maestro let slip, Jamie?
Well, come on, Mark. They wouldn't be surprises if you let them slip.
Indeed.
No way.
Good point.
To begin the 100th landmark season of the Flint Symphony Orchestra, they're going to perform a lesser-known work by Edvard Grieg, The Last Spring. It's the very first work that the Flint Symphony Orchestra performed almost exactly a century ago.
And it's actually a piece, and I don't know why it was chosen. We don't have the precise definition why it was chosen to be, because it's not a very well-known piece. So my feeling is because it was a small orchestration, And at the time, the orchestra was a small orchestra.
Yeah.
They were actually performing in Central High School in the auditorium, so which auditorium is quite small in the stage. So I think that probably was because it was in a small orchestra.
In addition, there's for Black Classical Origins, there's some Gershwin and Bernstein in that concert, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, in February, yes. We are performing selections from Porgy and Bess, but we are doing also the Martin Gould arrangement of Porgy and Bess. It's a suite. Also West Side Story by Bernstein.
Very different pairings of Marie Antoni and then Porgy and Bess.
Yes, Porgy and Bess. But it's in a way to bring out the America that we all know, that in one of the classics, two classics, operas or musicals or whatever you want to call them, of the American composers. Porgy and Bess, of course, struck everyone, written by Gershwin. But West Side Story went to be in a Broadway show, to a movie, then won Oscars. And I had to confess that when I was a kid, I was in Mexico, and in the town we used to live, movies would come like 3 or 4 years later. Mm. Only the ones who would make it to our town were the ones that were famous. You would never go just to see any movie. Were movies that really were good, and they lasted long enough in Mexico City, so they thought they would be making a good impression in the inner country. It was not just like putting something there and people would go to the movies. No, it had to be something that was well received, or even more than that, you know? And West Side Story was one of those movies being shown there. But in the name in Spanish, it was translated into love with no barriers, no boundaries. So I was only 11. So I need to ask permission. My father, my brother, and I had to ask if we could go and see the movie with that name, Love. In those days, you know, it was not accepted. A kid would go and see something and we had to do, I mean, especially with that title. He said, no. My friends and were inviting us say, no, I don't think it's that way. It's just the name of the movie. But I think it's more than just that. It's about Romeo and Juliet, apparently that's what they say about Romeo and Juliet in the 20th century in New York City. So with that, we convinced our father, okay, Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare, okay. So we went to see West Side Story, and oh, I loved it. And everyone was so surprised because I didn't know what was going on. And of course, being sung in English with super titles, and a lot of people got tired and couldn't understand it. But the music was enough to guide you, and we were just in total awe, my brother and I. We sang the pieces and the songs for months. We would do the dancing in the streets, and we feel like one was the Jets and the other one was the Sharks. So we had so much fun. It was a blast. So doing it here for this time, you know, it's always a pleasure to do. It's always something I look forward to.
We're speaking with Maestro Enrique Domecq and getting a preview of some of the selections coming to the Flint Symphony Orchestra during their 2016-17 season. This also marks the 100th anniversary of the first performance of the Flint Symphony, so Maestro Domecq is pulling out all the stops, including adding something to his already full plate.
I'm going to be composing. Yes. So far, everything is just in my head, but it's going to be composed in dedication to Flint. Mm. And to the orchestra.
A bit of a tone poem?
It's a tone poem, exactly. Yeah. It's going to have probably 4 sections and telling different periods of Flint and the orchestra. And we had to do with industrial moments of the city, the development of the city, and the creation of the orchestra, and how the orchestra was being developed, as well as the city was growing. And I touch a little bit of the moments of grief, than when all the big factories were leaving. But it's going to be in a positive way. So why in a town like this, we have an orchestra and it's been going for 100 years. So it's going to have a wonderful bang ending, because we have to celebrate a wonderful thing that ever happened in this city and in this world, because it's a participation of human beings that were created to enjoy life and to make people enjoy lives. And that's what music is all about. The piece is going to have eclecticism, so because I'm going to touch several different moments of the 100 years. So since we started in the industrial part of the lifetime, you know, 1917, when it was the biggest moments of turnovers in the world, the First World War I was finished and the Soviet Union was being created, or the revolution started in 1917. But here in the States, the development of the industrial life was beginning to be the most important part for this area. And the most important thing ever existed because of the car industry, because of the iron, because of all the industry that was going on here. So it was one of the most exciting moments of the United States. Then I would go into a position when we go into the turn of the century, or this century. So we have that wondering what was going to happen in the turn of the, from the 20 to the 21st century. There are a lot of things that we're saying, you know, that we're going to disappear, and then the world in general. But then it starts a new hope, and it starts a new way of thinking. I want to be on the positiveness of things.
All coming through the music.
Yes.
Which reminds me a lot, as you're talking about it, of an appearance of your favorite composer, as I understand it. You're going to be doing in November a bit of Mahler as well.
Yes, we're doing Mahler's Third Symphony. It's one of my, and you know, Gustav Mahler is my favorite composer, a super duper favorite composer, because the other ones are my favorite composers. And but the number three, it is a wonderful symphony because it has two elements. The first one is about the god, the Pan, which is bringing joyful things, and it's the moment when the summer begins, or talks about the summer, welcoming the summer, and then how to enjoy life. Then the other movements would describe each movement what every element of life would say, what the animals would tell us, what the flowers would tell us, what the air would tell us, and what would God would tell us, the angels. So it would be all in a way of how do we have to approach the world and listen to Mother Nature, to listen to life, to listen to the creators. And the creators are everywhere, where we can touch, where we can see, and we can smell, and we can sense. So all our five senses are going to be working to assimilate that. And that's what I love about that piece. I mean, that brings to you all this beauty and appreciation for life.
And the Mahler 3, I'm assuming you'll be with the Flint Festival chorus as well.
Yes.
That's one of two appearances that I know that the Flint Festival chorus will be bringing with the Flint Symphony Orchestra. There's the Mahler, and then there's one later on in May as well.
Yeah, for the closing of the season, we have two selections by Beethoven. The first one is the Choral Fantasy, which includes a piano solo and the chorus and a few soloists. And then we close the season of the 100th anniversary, which would be right there, with Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Mm.
Maestro Enrique de Mec, with a preview of the landmark 100th anniversary season, the 2016-17 season of the Flint Symphony Orchestra. More information about these concerts and more is online at thefso.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, the Listening Ear Crisis Intervention Center has been open 24 hours a day in East Lansing, 365 days a year, since July 15, 1969. It provides free and confidential service for telephone and walk-in clients in crisis. For Current State's weekly Neighbors in Action segment, we'll speak with Ian Jacobs about the history and the present of the Listening Ear. That's Wednesday here on Current State. The executive producer of the program is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. Politics, education, the environment, music, theater, stories from around the state in your hometown. The Current State podcast at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get quality podcasts. Glad you could join us today. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR.